Chapter 2, Rules of Engagement. I've always been interested in anything old and weird. I was good at school, too. When I became a Christian in high school, I felt like I'd been born for Bible study. I know that level of interest in the Bible wasn't normal for a teenager. It was a bit of an obsession. I spent hours studying the Bible, as well as theology books. I took commentaries to study hall. Since there was no 12-step program for my addiction, I went to Bible college to feed it. After that, I was off to seminary. I wanted to be a biblical studies professor. So the next step was graduate school, where I finally focused on the Hebrew Bible and lots of dead ancient languages. I found biblical nirvana, at least until that Sunday morning when I saw Psalm 82 without English camouflage. Looking back, I can explain all my study, education, and learning before and after my Psalm 82 moment using two metaphors, a filter and a mosaic. Filtering the text. Filters are used to eliminate things in order to achieve a desired result. When we use them in cooking, the unwanted elements are dredged, strained, and discarded. When used in our cars, they prevent particles from interfering with performance. When we use them in email, they weed out what or whom we don't want to read. What's left is what we use, what contributes to our meal, our engine, our sanity. Most of my education was conducted in this way, using filters. It was no sinister plot. It's just what it was. The content I learned was filtered through certain presumptions and traditions that ordered the material for me, that put it into a system that made sense to my modern mind. The verses that didn't quite work with my tradition were problem passages that were either filtered out or consigned to the periphery of unimportance. I understand that a lot of well-meaning Bible students, pastors, and professors don't look at how they approach the Bible that way. I know I didn't. But it's what happens. We view the Bible through the lens of what we know and what's familiar. Psalm 82 broke my filter. More importantly, it alerted me to the fact that I'd been using one. Our traditions, however honorable, are not intrinsic to the Bible. They are systems we invent to organize the Bible. They are artificial. They are filters. Once I'd been awakened to this, it struck me as faithless to use a filter. But throwing away my filters cost me the system which I'd ordered scripture and doctrine in my mind. I was left with a lot of fragments. It didn't feel like it at the time, but that was the best thing that could have happened. The mosaic. The facts of the Bible are just pieces, bits of scattered data. Our tendency is to impose order, and to do that we apply a filter. But we gain a perspective that is both broader and deeper if we allow ourselves to see the pieces in their own wider context. We need to see the mosaic created by the pieces. If the Bible is really a theological and literary mosaic, the pattern in a mosaic often isn't clear up close. It may appear to be just a random assemblage of pieces. Only when you step back can you see the wondrous whole. Yes, the individual pieces are essential. Without them, there would be no mosaic. But the meaning of all the pieces is found in the completed mosaic. And a mosaic isn't imposed on the pieces, it derives from them. I now view Psalm 82 not as a passage that shredded my filter, but rather an important piece of a larger, mesmerizing mosaic. Psalm 82 has, at its core, the unseen realm and its interaction with the human world. And that psalm isn't the only piece like that. There are lots of them. In fact, the intersection of our domain and the unseen world, which includes the triune God, but also a much more numerous cast, is at the heart of biblical theology. My passion is to persuade you to remove your filter and begin to look at the pieces of Scripture as part of a mosaic, so that this big picture can begin to take focus. If you do it, you'll find, as I did, that this approach leads you to the answers to questions like, why is that in the Bible? And how can I make sense of all this? If you spent serious time in Scripture, you know that there are many odd passages, curious phrases, troubling paradoxes, echoes of one event in another, connections within and between the Testaments that can't be coincidental. Obstacles and protocols. There are some serious obstacles to transitioning from seeing the Bible through filters to allowing all of its pieces to form a mosaic. I've experienced all of them. Number one, we've been trained to think that the history of Christianity is the true context of the Bible. We talk a lot about interpreting the Bible in context, but Christian history is not the context of biblical writers. The proper context for interpreting the Bible is not Augustine or any other church fathers. It's not the Catholic Church. It's not the rabbinic movements of late antiquity and the Middle Ages. It's not the Reformation or the Puritans. It is not evangelicalism in any of its flavors. It is not the modern world at all, or any period of its history. The proper context for interpreting the Bible is the context of the biblical writers, the context that produced the Bible. Every other context is alien to biblical writers and therefore to the Bible. Yet there is a pervasive tendency in the believing church to filter the Bible through creeds, confessions, and denominational preferences. I'm not arguing that we should ignore our Christian forefathers. I'm simply saying that we should give their words and their thoughts the proper perspective and priority. Creeds serve a useful purpose. They distill important, albeit carefully selected, theological ideas. But they are not inspired. There are no substitute for the biblical text. The biblical text was produced by men who lived in the ancient Near East and Mediterranean between the 2nd millennium BC and the 1st century AD. To understand how biblical writers thought, we need to tap into the intellectual output of that world. A vast amount of that material is available to us thanks to modern technology. As our understanding of the worldview of the biblical writers grow, so does our understanding of what they intended to say, and the mosaic of their thinking takes shape in our minds. Number two, we've been desensitized to the vitality and theological importance of the unseen world. Modern Christianity suffers from two serious shortcomings when it comes to the supernatural world. First, many Christians claim to believe in the supernatural, but think and live like skeptics. We find talk of the supernatural world uncomfortable. This is typical of denominations and evangelical congregations outside the charismatic movement. In other words, those from a background like the one I grew up in. There are two basic reasons why non-charismatics tend to close the door on the supernatural world. One is their suspicion that charismatic practices are detached from sound aegises of Scripture. As a biblical scholar, it's easy for me to agree with that suspicion. But over time, it has widely degenerated into a closed-minded overreaction that is itself detached from the worldview of the biblical writers. The other reason is less self-congratulatory. The believing church is bending under the weight of its own rationalism, a modern worldview that would be foreign to the biblical writers. Traditional Christian teaching has for centuries kept the unseen world at arm's length. We believe in the Godhead because there's no point to Christianity without it. The rest of the unseen world is handled with a whisper or a chuckle. The second serious shortcoming is evident when the charismatic movement, within the charismatic movement, the elevation of experience over scripture. While that movement is predisposed to embrace the idea that an animate spiritual world, its conception of that world is framed largely by experience and an idiosyncratic reading of the Book of Acts. Those two shortcomings, while seemingly quite different, are actually born of the same fundamental underlying problem. Modern Christianity's view of the unseen world isn't framed by the ancient worldview of the biblical writers. One segment wrongly consigns the invisible realm to the periphery of theological discussions. The other is so busy seeking some interaction with it that it has become unconcerned with its biblical moorings, resulting in a caricature. I'm concerned about both shortcomings, but since this book derives from my own story, the problem of the Christian skeptic is closer to home and is my greater concern. If your background, like mine, is in the evangelical non-charismatic branch of Protestantism, perhaps you consider yourself an exception to the patterns I've identified, or think that I've overstated the situation. But what would you think if a Christian friend confided to you that he believed that he'd been helped by a guardian angel, or that he'd audibly heard a disembodied voice warning him of some danger? What if your friend claimed to have witnessed demonic possession, or was convinced that God had directed her life through a dream that included an appearance of Jesus? Most of us non-charismatics would have to admit that our initial impulse would be to doubt. But we actually have a less transparent reflex. We would nod our heads and listen politely to our friend's fervent story, but the whole time we would be seeking other possible explanations. That's because our modern inclination is to insist on evidence. Since we live in a scientific age, we are prone to think that these kind of experiences are actually emotional misinterpretation of the events, or worse, something treatable with the right medication. And in any individual case, that might be so. But the truth is that our modern evangelical subculture has trained us to think that our theology precludes any experience of the unseen world. Consequently, it isn't an important part of our theology. My contention is that if our theology really derives from the biblical text, we must consider our selective supernatural and recover a biblical theology of the unseen world. This is not to suggest that the best interpretation of a passage is always the most supernatural one, but the biblical writers and those whom they to whom they wrote were predisposed to supernaturalism. To ignore that outlook or marginalize it will produce Bible interpretation that reflects our mindset more than that of the biblical writers. 3. We assume that a lot of things in the Bible are too odd or peripheral to matter. Sometime after we moved to Wisconsin for my doctoral work, my wife and I found a church that felt as if it might become our new church home. The pastor had a degree from a well-known seminary. His first two sermons from 1 Peter were filled with solid exposition. I was excited about the prospects. By our third visit, he had reached 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 14 through 22 in his sermon series. A very odd passage. That's also one of my favorites. What happened next is etched in my memory. The pastor took the pulpit and announced with complete sincerity, "We're going to skip this section of 1 Peter since it's just too strange." We didn't visit again. I've seen this sort of evasion more than once. Usually it's not as dramatic. Pastors don't typically tell their people to skip part of the Bible. The more common strategy for handling strange passages is the more subtle. Strip the bizarre passage of anything that makes it bizarre. The goal is to provide the most ordinary, comfortable interpretation possible. This strategy is ironic, to say the least. Why is it that Christians who would strenuously defend the belief in God or the virgin birth against charges that they are unscientific or irrational don't hesitate to call out academic SWAT teams to explain away weird Bible passages? The core doctrines of faith are themselves neither ordinary nor a comfortable fit with empirical rationalism. The odds are very high that you've never heard that Psalm 82 plays a pivotal role in biblical theology, including New Testament theology. I've been a Christian for over 30 years, and I've never heard a sermon on it. There are many other passages whose content is curious or doesn't make sense, and so are abandoned or glossed over. Here's a sampling of them. Genesis 1. Verse 26, Genesis 3, verses 5 and 22, Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4, Genesis chapter 10 and 11, Genesis 15, verse 1, Genesis 48, verses 15 and 16, Exodus 3, verses 1 through 14. Exodus 23, verses 20 through 23. Numbers 13, verses 32 and 33. Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9. Deuteronomy 32, verse 17. Judges 6. 1 Samuel chapter 3. 1 Samuel 23 verses 1 through 14. 1 Kings 22 verses 1 through 23. 2 Kings 5 verse 17 through 19. Job chapter 1 and 2. Psalms 82, 68, 89. Isaiah chapter 14, verses 12 through 15. Ezekiel 28, 11 through 19. Daniel chapter 7. Matthew 16, verses 13 through 23. John 1, 1 through 14. John 10, 34 through 35. Romans 8, 18 through 24. Romans 15, verses 24, 28. 1 Corinthians 2, verses 6 through 13. 1 Corinthians 5, 4 through 5. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 3. 1 Corinthians 10, 18 through 22. Galatians 3, verse 19. Ephesians 6, 10 through 12. Hebrew 1 and 2. 1 Peter 3, 18 through 22. 2 Peter 1, 3 and 4. 2 Peter 2, 4 and 5. Jude 5 through 7. Revelation 2, 26 through 28. Revelation 3, verse 21. Don't consider that a mere catalog. The list is deliberate, and all those passages will be examined in this book. All are conceptually interconnected and help illuminate the more commonly studied passages, those that do make sense. Look them up for a glimpse of what we'll be talking about. How are we supposed to understand the identity of the sons of God in Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4? Why did Jesus angrily rebuke Peter by saying, "Get behind me, Satan"? Why does Paul tell the Corinthian church to stop arguing because they would someday rule over angels? There are lots of explanations offered by pastors and teachers of the Bible for these and other strange passages, but most are offered without consideration of how the explanation works with the rest of the Bible, with passages strange or not so strange. In this book, I'll be offering my take on many strange passages. Other scholars have done the same. But if mine are different, it's because they grow out of the perspective of the Mosaic. They don't exist in isolation from other passages. They have explanatory powers in more than one place. My point is not to suggest that we can have absolute certainty interpretation everywhere in the Bible. No one, including the present writer, is always right about what every passage means. I have a firm grasp of my own lack of omniscience. So does my wife, for the record. Rather, my contention in this book is that if it's weird, it's important. Every passage plays a coherent role in the Mosaic whole. I've said that the Mosaic of biblical theology gives coherence to the pieces of the Bible, but the Bible is a long, detailed work. One of the hardest parts about writing this book was deciding what to reserve for another book, or how to be comprehensive without being exhaustive. I decided to cheat. The present book is a culmination of years of my time spent reading and studying the biblical text and exploring the insights of other scholars. I've accumulated thousands of books and scholarly journal articles that relate in some way to the ancient biblical worldview that produces the Mosaic. I've read nearly all of them in part or whole. My bibliography is nearly as long as this book. I mention this to make it clear that the ideas you'll read here are not contrived. All of them have survived what scholars call peer review. My main contribution is synthesis of the ideas and articulating a biblical theology not derived from tradition, but rather framed exclusively in the context of the Bible's own ancient worldview. The present book is academic in tone, but it's not necessarily a book for scholars. You don't need to have gone to seminary or earned an advanced degree to follow along. I've tried to reserve technical discussions to a companion website to this book that will provide fuller discussion on certain topics, additional bibliography, and nuts and bolts data about the original language for those who desire that. For those whom this book may feel too dense, I've written a less detailed version entitled Supernatural. It covers the core concepts of this book with an orientation toward practical application of the supernatural worldview of the biblical writers, toward how the biblical mosaic presented here should change our spiritual lives and outlook. The subtitle of this book, Recovering the Supernatural Worldview of the Bible, captures the struggle of being a modern person with a believing heart trying to think like a pre-modern biblical writer. If you can feel even a little of that conflict, you're where I've been for a long time, and I'm still on that journey. Somewhere along the way, I came to believe that I didn't need protection from my Bible. If you believe that too, you're good to go.